The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
One of the things I most appreciate about the Buddhist teachings and the practices that are offered is that we are essentially asked to explore in our direct experience, in our own experience, what's happening, and to be curious about whether the teachings and how the teachings resonate in our direct experience, in our lives. So this kind of approach for me was very congenial. I tend to be kind of math and science oriented. And so it's kind of like, okay, I'm willing to treat what the Buddha says as a hypothesis and then run the experiment. I'll run the experiment on my own body and mind and see what happens. And that was very congenial for me. And I think it's... It allows us to investigate for ourselves, to come and see for ourselves, how does this teaching, how does this understanding that the Buddha offered resonate for us? So there's a story in the suttas that I wanted to share with you about some people at the time of the Buddha who were not his practitioners, not followers of the Buddha. Instead, they lived in a crossroads area in India where there were a lot of wanderers and a lot of teachers that came and went. They would come to their town and stop, and they'd offer teachings, and the people of the town would listen to the teachings, and then somebody else would come through and offer their teachings, and they'd listen to those teachings, and they began to recognize that people were saying things that contradicted each other. And they basically would expound their own teachings and dismiss the teachings of other people, and the people in the town began getting confused, and so the Buddha came to town, and they decided that rather than just the description is that when they heard that the Buddha was coming through, they said, well, we hear really good reports about the Buddha. We hear really good reports about this recluse, so let's go listen to him. But instead of simply listening, they bring a question to the Buddha. Maybe they're trying to circumvent just being told something else to disagree with everybody else's teachings. But in any case, the beginning of this teaching is... they start when they come. They greet the Buddha. They bow to him. They greet him respectfully, and then one of them says, "Bhante, there are some ascetics and Brahmins who come to Kesaputta. That's the name of the town, Kesaputta. They explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, denigrate, deride, and denounce the doctrines of others." But then some other ascetics and Brahmins come to Kesaputta, and they too explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, denigrate, deride, and denounce the doctrines of others. We are perplexed and in doubt as to which of these good ascetics speak the truth and which speak falsehood. So they're presenting their confusion to him. They're presenting that, you know, we're hearing all these different teachings, and how do we know what to believe? How can we know what is true? You know, this situation, you know, the Bay Area is kind of this kind of a situation. We have so many different kinds of teachings. And in Buddhist teachings alone, there's the Zen tradition, there's the Tibetan tradition, there's the Theravada tradition. And then there's, you know, I know some people who follow Celtic traditions and who work with people who channel angels. And there's all kinds of different spiritual traditions in this area, including all of the Christian traditions, the Judeo traditions, the Muslim traditions. So there's so many different traditions here. And their question is, how do we know what's true? How do we know what's right? What should we believe? And the Buddha's response is actually pretty interesting. He starts out, you might think, so that they've said, we are in doubt as to which of these good ascetics speak the truth. The first thing that the Buddha says is, it is fitting for you to be perplexed. It is fitting for you to be in doubt. Doubt has arisen in you about a perplexing matter. I have all of these people coming and saying all these contradictory things. The Buddha is pointing to, it's very natural for one to not understand or know how to evaluate these statements or these teachings. And then the Buddha goes on. And this also gets interesting. So I'll just read this part and then talk about it a little bit. He says, come, don't go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by a collection of scriptures. And this is the first part. Don't, basically, in terms of what to believe or take to be true, he's saying basically any kind of information that comes in, whether it's coming in through books or through oral traditions or lineages or through hearsay or collections of scriptures, basically all of the ways that we get knowledge. He says don't, and when he says don't go by these things, my understanding in terms of what he means here is not, and this comes through a kind of a fuller understanding as we go through the entirety of the text, this is what comes across to me. He's not saying discount what you take in. But he's saying just because somebody said it to you, just because it's in the scriptures, just because everybody you know says it's true, it's not enough for you to take it as a grounds for believing it. So he's not saying, and this I think is misunderstood sometimes when this passage is explored. He says, don't go by oral traditions, by lineage, teaching, hearsay, or collection of scriptures. People say, well, it means you're not supposed to pay attention to anything that people say. And that's not actually what he's saying. I think what he's saying is it's not sufficient, that there needs to be more than just people saying it's true, more than it being handed down by history, more than it's in a scripture. There needs to be something more that we do with this information. And so that's one set of things he says to not. So we could say, don't go only by. Don't use this as your grounds for what you believe, as the sole ground for what you believe. And then he goes on to say, also don't go by logical reasoning, by inferential reasoning, by reasoned cogitation, by the acceptance of a view after pondering. So this is thinking about how we take information in and think about it. So we might think that might be the next thing, that we've gotten information and the next thing we should do is think about it. Do I believe this? Do I agree with this? And again, I think he's not saying that we should not do that, because there are many places in the teachings where he encourages us to reflect on teachings, to use our intellect to think about teaching. But again, he's saying it's not sufficient. Actually, I think partly what he's pointing to here is something that I've seen and understood in my own mind. When I have a view or a belief in my mind, or if there's conditioning there's no if about it. There's conditioning in my being. My life has been sculpted, constructed based on conditioning, based on what my parents believed, the place I grew up, based on what schools I went to, based on how people treated me on the playground, how I learned in school. All of those things have shaped me. And that shaping has an impact on how I take information in and how I think about it. And so even our own reasoning can be biased. Even our own thinking about things can have a skew to it. And so I think this is partly what he's pointing to here, that it's not enough. So in taking in information, if we think about it, thinking about, do I believe this? You know, does it make sense to me? That very reflection can be skewed by beliefs, by views, by conditioning. And so again, that too isn't enough to ground our beliefs in. And so he goes on, he says, and also don't go by the seeming competence of a speaker or because you think this person is my teacher. So again, he's pointing to, sometimes we have people who are teachers who say things that sound so true. And, you know, I think this is, I was reading various commentaries, modern commentaries on this text this afternoon while I was thinking about giving this talk. And one of them pointed out that in the Buddha's day, certainly in our day, it's very tempting when some teacher says, it's like this, this is the truth, this is the way it is. It's like we feel some kind of comfort that somebody knows. Somebody's saying, this is what's true, you should just believe that. There's kind of a way that's almost a human tendency to want to gravitate towards somebody who says things with very definitive statements. And yet this is what, in this town, this is what these other teachers were doing. They were coming to town and saying, and this is what's true. Maybe the first teachers that came to town, they were like, oh, we've heard the true teachings. And then somebody else comes to town and says, and this is what's true, and it directly contradicts the people before. And so how does one deal with that? Do you dismiss the second people? Do you dismiss the first people? Do you come up with something new? And so the Buddha is pointing to pretty much undermining or saying, in all the usual ways that we typically think of as finding what we should believe, or they've asked him, you know, how can we figure out what's the truth? And he's basically saying, most of the ways that you think about figuring out the truth are not sufficient. And they're not gonna work. And then he goes on, he says, when you know for yourselves, these things are unwholesome. These things, if accepted and undertaken, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. And he goes on for a little bit, and I'll talk about this in a moment, but then he also says, and when you know for yourselves, these things are wholesome. These things, when undertaken, these things are wholesome. These things are blameless. These things are praised by the wise. These things, if accepted and undertaken, lead to welfare and happiness. Then you should live in accordance with them. And so he's got both sides. He's asking people to look in their own experience. Is something wholesome? Is it unwholesome? Is it blameworthy? Is it censured by the wise? If it's accepted and undertaken, does it lead to harm and suffering? Then it should be abandoned. So here, I think this is really interesting, because here he's not talking about discovering truth per se. He's talking about, do actions create suffering or not? Can we tell? We can tell in our own experience. Do actions create suffering? If they create suffering, if they create harm, then we should explore moving in the direction of letting go of those actions, that direction. If they're wholesome, if they are, if they're wholesome, if they're blameless, if they're praised by the wise, if they're accepted and undertaken, they lead to welfare and happiness, then live in accordance with those things. So that's not answering the question, is it true? It's answering the question, does it lead to freedom from suffering? That's a different question. It's a different way of approaching what it's about. Now, some of the commentators on this actually pointed out, some of the people who wrote about this teaching actually pointed out that, so if you tell some people, when you know for yourself, these things are, you know, and sometimes the word might be good, these things are good, these things lead to happiness, then you should practice in accordance with those things. They might, using their own understanding of what's good, of what leads to happiness, not actually end up doing things that lead to somebody else's harm and suffering. And so this is an important piece of the teaching, and somebody points out that the Buddha had a sense of confidence that they had a strong ethical sense, that these people had a very strong, developed ethical sense when he gave them this teaching, because it would be very easy for somebody to say, oh, well, what's good is what's good for me. But in many places in the suttas, the Buddha explicitly says, when things are practiced and they do not lead to affliction for yourself or another or both, that should be cultivated. And so it's really asking us to come into relationship with not only ourselves but with others, and to investigate, to recognize, is how I'm engaging in the world, is it creating harm anywhere? And this is not an easy practice. So to me, what this is pointing to, what this is saying, is that we need to put into practice and use our awareness, our mindfulness, to investigate, do these actions lead to harm here, to suffering, to affliction in my to myself or to another or to both? This is a lot of our work as we explore our experience, as we begin to open in mindfulness to our practice. I mean, we might in our kind of usual way of meeting the world, we might think, well, when I want something, when I need something, when I act to get something, then, you know, that does give me some happiness. And it gives us a kind of happiness. It does give us a kind of happiness. But that kind of happiness often is at the expense of, it's at the expense of our, what happens in that kind of exploration or that kind of acting out of, you know, needing to have something or needing to get rid of something. If that's how we think happiness is found, I will create the conditions in the world where I'm surrounded by things that are pleasant, I get rid of things that are unpleasant. If that's the way we're navigating the world, then basically what we're doing is we are kind of thinking about in the future, if I get rid of this thing, then I'll be happy. Or thinking about in the future, if I get this thing, then I'll be happy. And so in a way, what we're doing is foregoing in this moment right now a kind of ease of heart for the idea that some point in the future we'll have something that will make us happy. So there's a way in which that movement of mind to say, if I can get rid of this thing, if I can just get rid of this thing, that's what will make me happy. This is a lot of what our reactivity is about, our emotions that create stress, create suffering for us, anger, confusion, irritation, fear, pride, arrogance, all of these emotions that can create suffering for ourselves and for others. They have this kind of attitude in the mind where they are kind of projecting into the future. When I get this thing, then I'll be happy. When I get rid of this thing, then I'll be happy. And we do, in a moment when we actually get it or get rid of it, there can be a moment of release, of, oh, I figured it out. I've gotten rid of that thing, and I've in control. I've figured out how to control my life. And there can be a sense of, things are good. And they're good for about, you know, a few moments. And then we realize we have to keep going. We're kind of on this cycle of needing. It's like we understand that things don't last very long. And so it's like, okay, well, what's the next thing I need to do? That one's figured out. That one's under control. But that over there, that's not under control. So, okay, I'll work on that one now. And we are almost continually turning towards the world, trying to control, to fix, to change, to manipulate the world to be the way we think we'd like it to be. And in that very movement, we are not noticing that the wanting for things to be different, that the aversion to something that's unpleasant, that those things themselves, that the wanting, the aversion themselves are painful, are unpleasant, we miss through the projection into the future, we miss the suffering that our minds, our hearts are creating here and now through the aversion, through the wanting. It's like our minds are willing to ignore the suffering of the wanting this thing or to get rid of that thing because we are projecting into the future when we get that thing or get rid of that thing. So we are willing to forego and ignore the suffering that's happening right now, the distress that's happening right now, for some idea, some thought in our mind that we'll get something or get rid of something in the future. And if we actually start to look at this process, and this is what the Buddha asks us to do, to begin to look at these patterns, to look at greed, to look at aversion in the mind, and begin to recognize what happens. And here he asks the Kalamas, he says, what do you think when greed arises in a person? Is it for his welfare or for his harm? And they have enough understanding to recognize when greed arises in someone, it's for his harm. There are some certainly I didn't have this kind of understanding. You know, there was a way in which my mind, before I met the practice, thought that the desire to have things was for my benefit. That greed, that desire to construct things, to fix things, to get things, that was helping me. And there is, I want to point to here, because this can be misunderstood. So many of the teachings, if they're not kind of filled out, there can be a misunderstanding. There is a form of aspiration, of movement in a direction, of a kind of a wish to accomplish, to grow, to provide for ourselves and for our families, that is not about greed, but is about just the simple, natural movement to take care of oneself and one's families, kind of rooted in kindness, rooted in compassion for ourselves. And so there is a way that compassion The movement of compassion wishes to alleviate suffering. That's the natural movement of compassion. The movement of metta naturally wishes to connect and to provide, to be of support, to be of to be caring, to be connected. And so these movements of mind, these wisdom, compassion, generosity, love, have action. You know, they want to make us act. But it's not about greed. And so there's a difference in the feeling. We could call that the greed a kind of a needy desire or a constricted desire. It's like we have a desire that we feel can only be satisfied in a certain way. Whereas the desire around compassion is more, it's kind of more flexible. It understands that there are different ways to respond and understands also that there may not be a way to alleviate that suffering, but that doesn't mean we don't try. So it's not about not acting here. This is an important piece to recognize as we begin to explore greed and aversion and delusion, because when we are caught by the story of greed, the belief in that story is that I need that thing. The belief in aversion is I have to get rid of that thing in order to be happy. And greed, for instance, that belief that I have to have that thing in order to be happy, that's the needy part of greed. And when we actually begin to explore greed in our mindfulness practice, and this is what I understand it to be about when he says you should abandon things that lead to harm and suffering. Greed leads to harm and suffering, as he's pointing to here. This should be abandoned. Abandoning greed is not about simply trying to say, okay, I see greed isn't useful, I'll stop being greedy. Or likewise with aversion, you know, it's recognizing, oh, I see aversion isn't helpful, so I'll stop not liking things. I'll stop being averse to things. Good luck. You know, that is just not the way our minds work. They have been conditioned towards greed. They have been conditioned towards aversion. Most of what we've been taught in our lives, the conditioning of our lives, has taught us that this is the way to happiness. Just simply understanding intellectually, you know, so hearing a teaching here. So this is a teaching from the Buddha. So, you know, okay, greed leads to harm and suffering. What we're asked to do with that, not simply to believe it and then say, okay, I should stop doing that. Again, that's not going to work. But to begin to investigate. So this is where the practice comes in. This is where when we know for ourselves, greed leads to harm and suffering. Aversion leads to suffering for ourselves and others. Then we begin to understand what abandoning means. And so an example around aversion. When I began exploring anger in my practice, I could see that I couldn't just turn it off. I couldn't just stop it. But I was just exploring it. So this was my practice, to notice when it arose, to be aware of it, to recognize it. Okay, this is anger. This is a different approach than being angry. It's a recognizing that anger is happening. A recognizing that this is what it is for a human being to experience anger. And so this was the practice, and this was what I learned from reading a book about Buddhism. So there was some teaching. And instead of just trying to believe it and say, okay, anger is bad, I'm going to stop it, I used the practice to begin to investigate in my own life. So this teaching says anger is harmful. It says, opening to it with mindfulness might be helpful. Am I willing to run that experiment? And I was. I was willing to explore that. I didn't understand how it would work. I had no idea. It's like it made no sense to me that paying attention to anger would somehow lead to its weakening or its abandonment. But I read this book and it said, hey, this has worked for me. Why don't you try it? And I was willing. So there was some degree of willingness to have a sense of confidence that, okay, this is somebody who says this is wise, you know, somebody that sounds wise. So I'm going to try this in my own experience. So this is essentially following what the Buddha says here. Try it. Come and see. Try it in your own life. See what happens. And as I began to do this, as I began to explore anger in my life, one of the first bits of wisdom that I gained, it sounds so obvious, but this particular anger was to a particular person who had done something to me that I thought was not so kind, and I was very angry with that person. And through this being with the anger, I began to recognize that I had the belief, and this just happened through kind of hanging out with the anger, noticing it, being with it. I began to recognize I had the belief that this anger was going to make the person I was angry at miserable. That somehow, that's what I thought I was getting out of this anger. That it was going to make somebody else feel miserable. And as I reflected on my situation, which was I was in the middle of the South Pacific. I had joined the Peace Corps, and I was 7,000 miles away from the person that I was angry with. We were not in any kind of communication, and that person had no clue that I was angry. There was no way that this anger was somehow magically like transversing the ocean and making that person miserable. So it's pretty clear to me that the belief that underlied that anger, that the kind of benefit that I was getting from that anger, yeah, this person's going to be really miserable when they get, you know, when they get the hit of this anger. It's like, that wasn't happening. And at the same time, what I saw is, wow, this anger hurts. This hurts here. This anger hurts me. That was a revelation. It sounds so obvious in a way, but my system had not really taken in the pain that this anger was causing me because it was thinking about and believing it was going to cause somebody else harm. And I've since learned that there's a story in the Buddhist teachings that this anger, this quality of dosa, is the Pali word, is like picking up a hot coal to throw at somebody. So you've got this idea that, you know, you're going to cause the other person pain by lashing out at them, by throwing this hot coal at them. But you burn yourself first. And so it creates pain not only for another person when you throw the hot coal at them, but it creates pain for yourself. And so this gets revealed, this understanding. Yes, aversion is to my own detriment. And likewise with greed, we begin to understand the kind of the stickiness, the tightness, the contractedness around greed. The not okayness if I don't get this thing. Or if I do get it, the kind of contractedness around trying to keep it, the fear around trying to keep it. So there's a kind of a way that we miss the suffering of these states, greed, aversion, confusion. And so this exploration through mindfulness begins to point it out to us. And so we see directly for ourselves It's not a matter of believing it. We understand directly, oh, anger hurts. This is not leading to well-being. Greed hurts. This is not leading to well-being. There's another place that the Buddha points to this in another teaching. He says, he goes through this with respect to all sense experience and whatever happens in our minds too here, but here he's just pointing to the eye, but he goes through it with respect to what we hear, what we smell, what we taste, what we think, what we believe. He says, having seen something with the eye, when one knows greed, hate, and delusion are in me, and one knows when greed, hate, and delusion are not in me. So it says, having seen an object with the eye, one knows when greed, hate, and delusion are within. Having seen something with the eye, one knows when greed, hate, and delusion are not within. So this is about knowing for ourselves when something happens that we want it, that contracted feeling. When we want to get rid of it, that feeling of burning, a confused spinning feeling. This is not difficult to recognize when we are curious, when we start to get curious about looking at our own experience. It's not difficult to recognize when the heart feels constricted, when it feels like, oh, I gotta have that thing. Oh, I gotta get rid of that thing. The feeling in the heart begins to be our guide. And here he goes on. When you know this, greed, hate, and delusion are in me, or greed, hate, and delusion are not in me, are these things experienced through faith or liking or what's been acquired through hearing or by reasoning or by thinking about something? No, it's understood through direct experience. And this is what he's pointing to in this teaching to the Kalamas, that understanding in our own experience, greed is not helpful, aversion is not helpful, delusion is not helpful. And then he goes on to say the wholesome things are non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. So when we're motivated, and non-greed could be understood to be generosity, non-aversion, understood to be love. Non-delusion, understood to be wisdom, if we want to put it in the positive term. And so generosity, love, and wisdom, when they are motivating us, our heart feels very different. When we're acting from love, from compassion, from generosity, it doesn't have quite that feeling of constriction. There's much more of the sense of an open heart responding to the world rather than reacting to the world. So this is essentially come and see. Come and see for yourself. To me, that's very much what the Buddha is asking of us, to listen to the teachings. So it's not just dismiss the teachings. One point somebody said to me, I know the Buddha says we're not supposed to believe anything he says. And I said, no, that is not what the Buddha said. That is not what the Buddha said. The Buddha asked us to evaluate and explore what he says in our practice. There's a way that we may, and for me, certainly, there was a way. It was kind of, I had to take it as a hypothesis. Paying attention to my anger will lead to some kind of transformation of that anger. Being mindful of it will be helpful in some way. I had no idea how that would work. And so there was a measure of trust, a measure of willingness to take up somebody else's view and try it on, see what happens. It was not very long before I directly understood how useful it was. a matter of a few weeks before I began to see some of the benefits, and a few months before I clearly understood just how powerful this practice is. So that, for me, was my own process of trying it and seeing, you know, running the experiment, and having a sense of confidence that I now understand for myself this is useful. I don't have to believe what somebody else says. And again, it's not about truth here. It's about what is useful in terms of leading to well-being. So, to end this teaching, the Buddha said, actually, he said, the next thing he said was, when you have kind of explored this possibility of letting go of, and here he uses the words, when one is devoid of longing, devoid of ill will, unconfused, clearly comprehending, mindful, one dwells pervading the world with mindfulness, with loving kindness, with compassion, with joy, and with equanimity. And so he's pointing to that as these things fall away, as greed, aversion, delusion fall away, we're not left with a nothingness. We are left with love, with compassion, with joy, with equanimity, with some wisdom, with a responsive heart that responds to the world instead of one that kind of clenches and reacts. And he also said, and this, I think, is pointing back to their initial questions. You know, how do we know what's true? The commentaries say, or some of the more modern commentaries say that this part of the sutta says that that what they were being asked to believe were kind of things about the nature of rebirth. You know, things about the nature of whether people are reborn or not, whether this is the only life, and there were various teachers preaching various different things about that. And how do I know what's true? And the Buddha here at the end says, essentially, he to summarize this, I'll just summarize it instead of reading it. He says, it doesn't matter whether you believe there is rebirth or not. This practice of exploring the what leads to exploring what in experience leads towards well-being will lead towards well-being here and now. Whether if there's another world, I mean, if there is rebirth, then there's a benefit because you are engaging in a way that creates conditions for a wholesome rebirth. If you're engaging in wholesome actions here and now, that tends to be what comes. He says, if there's not rebirth, then you benefit here and now from having ease of heart. And so he points to that. It doesn't matter what you believe here. What matters is this freedom from suffering. And that can be experienced here and now. We don't have to wait to experience that. So again, he's pointing not to believe something, but what is useful in terms of well-being. And he has many teachings that are useful to pick up and explore. And his is a practice. That's another thing I really appreciated about the Buddha's teaching. It wasn't simply about, for me, the religion of my upbringing. My understanding of it as a child, as a teenager, was that I was being asked to believe something that I could not verify, and that I just had to believe it, that was what was asked. I was just asked to believe that. And my when I met the Buddhist teaching, he says, here's something that's useful, that greed, aversion, and delusion create suffering in your own heart. Try being mindful of them. Try recognizing that. See for yourself if it is painful. And what I began to discover as I did see for myself that anger hurt, that greed was painful, what began to happen was that it was like some amazing process in our human system begins to respond to that information. And so learning that anger hurt through direct experience, the system began to understand that so deeply that it, like, at one point, the kind of really the moment where I really firmly said, yes, this is, I am committed to this, this works, this, I understand this, was one moment when, after several months of watching this anger, and as I said, as I had began to recognize, anger hurts, as I'd seen that directly for myself, at one point, I was, you know, in my kitchen, and I was cutting an apple, and I was just, happened to be kind of present. I wasn't particularly trying to be mindful, but I was just there. I think, you know, the momentum of being with the anger over the course of those months had created some kind of momentum of mindfulness. And so I was cutting this apple, and I noticed in my mind a thought arise about the person I was angry with. And I noticed this kind of intention or this urge to jump on that thought and think more thoughts to get angry at that person. There was a kind of a habit of mind that said, yeah, that's what we do with this kind of thought. But seeing that, there's enough mindfulness there to see that kind of movement to anger, that intention, basically. The mind says, yeah, I want to get angry. Having seen enough in the previous few months that anger hurts, my system let go of that movement towards the anger. I didn't have to try to stop it. I didn't have to do anything. It was like, you know, you learn from experience, touching a pot on the hot stove, you know, that's not a good thing to do. Your system understands to not go there. This is what seems to happen as we explore with mindfulness, and our system begins to understand anger hurts, greed hurts, delusion is not useful. Our system begins to recognize, just don't go there. When it's seen that the mind is heading in that direction, it's like it was like the mind said, ooh, I know what's going to happen there. I don't think so. But I didn't have to do that. It was like my system took care of me because it understood. And so this is the power of that direct understanding. It's the power of that when we know for ourselves, these things, when undertaken, lead to welfare and happiness, then we go ahead that direction. These things, when undertaken, lead to harm and suffering, we abandon them. That moment when my mind recognized, oh, headed towards suffering, I don't think so, that was abandoning happening on its own. That's my understanding of what abandoning is. It's not that we try to do it. It's not that we say, oh, don't go there. It's the wisdom that's gained through this understanding that as we actually meet our experience, understand, oh, this is suffering. Oh, this is leading towards well-being. Our system begins to lead us away from suffering and towards well-being because basically, that's what our systems want to do. Our systems want to move towards well-being and happiness, but just have really fundamentally misunderstood how to do that. It's not gotten good information. Our system's gotten really messed up, confused, misperceptions, misunderstood how happiness can be found. And this come and see, look for yourself. Are these things leading towards happiness or not? Check it in your own experience. Be willing to really investigate. And your own being will start to find its own way towards happiness and freedom. So, it's time to stop. I'm going to continue working on these explorations of the suttas in the next coming weeks. I love the suttas, so I hope that you find this useful. May it be of use. Thank you.